First up this afternoon, I am joined by Dr. Charles O'Mahony. He's a law lecturer and head of the law school at NUI Galway. Good afternoon, Dr. O'Mahony.
Hi, Ciara. How are you doing?
I am good. Thank you very much for taking the time and joining me. A proposed bill on mental health reform. This is the Mental Health Amendment Bill 2021. Disappoints and fails to address key human rights issues. That is what TDs and senators were told yesterday. You were at this Oireachtas Subcommittee on Mental Health meeting yesterday. And you feel there are certain areas or four concerns you raised in particular with the proposed legislation. Enlighten us.
Thank you. I'm going to give you just some background to the bill. So it's been coming a long time. We have the Mental Health Act here in Ireland since 2001, and that replaced the Mental Treatment Act 1945. And that was a significant development when that 2001 Act was eventually commenced in 2006. So we had, for the first time, independent review of people who are involuntarily detained in approved centres, in hospitals, in psychiatric services in Ireland. Before that, we didn't have any oversight of people who were detained in psychiatric services. So we have a very bad history in this area. We had at one point over 21,000 people in 1958 at the peak of it, people who were involuntarily detained or that were resident in psychiatric hospitals. So the 2001 Act was a very important development when it was enacted in 2001 and commenced eventually in 2006. And there was a commitment then to review that Act, and this review has taken a very long time. There was a report in 2012 and a kind of final report then in 2015, and the Department of Health have done nothing with that report really for many years. And then last year we had this bill, HESA bill, published and approved by government in July 2021. So there's been a long road to get to this point, and I suppose ultimately there have been human rights concerns raised by people who have experience of the legislation, and they've raised, I suppose, significant human rights issues based on their own lived experience. And the bill, unfortunately, is published. While there's positive elements to it, for sure, it fails a number of key areas. I'm happy to talk to those areas.
Yeah, one of the first things I just want to bring up with you is this intermediate category. That's for those who do not meet criteria for involuntary admission, and this could widen the net of coercion, as you've noted. And you added that the lack of provision of a direct complaints mechanism is a major deficit within the Act from 2001 and the proposed bill for 2021.
That's right. In relation to this intermediate category, it's a new category that's proposed in the bill. So there, as it currently stands under the 2001 Act, there's two categories. Either you're a voluntary patient, as it provides for in the legislation, so you're voluntarily receiving mental health services in an approved centre, or you're involuntary, so you can be forced into a mental health service, approved centre, you can be brought there against your will, and you can be given medication and ECT against your will. So they're the two categories. But there is this kind of category that falls between these two. So you have people that are technically voluntary, they're not trying to leave an approved centre, but they may not have the mental capacity to consent. So there's no oversight for those people who, if they actually try to leave the approved centre, they will be probably met involuntary. So what that means is that they effectively have no oversight or protection around their de facto detention. So they are effectively detained and there's no oversight. So to address this, what the bill is proposing is that you'll have this intermediate category and there will be some review for those people. But I suppose the concern with that is that you have people that are currently considered voluntary patients, but that they can now be brought into this intermediate category and they can be coerced. So really what we feel would be the best thing to do would be to provide support. And there's a new piece of legislation, I'm not sure if you've heard about it, it's called the Assisted Decision-Making Capacity Act 2015. It hasn't been commenced yet, it's replacing the ward court system, and that provides for support for people where they may need some help to make decisions about lots of different things, including healthcare. And so it might be better if that piece of legislation focused more on providing supports to people falling into this category, rather than having this intermediate category where there are risks around that, potentially, while there's net of coercion.
Now, at the committee hearing, they heard, the TDs and senators, that a revolution is needed in terms of the mental health policy in this country. And Jennifer Huff was heard from yesterday. Her sister Valerie died by suicide in January 2021. And she criticised the tendency to prescribe medication for people with mental health issues. From your point of view, in terms of this revolution that's needed in the mental health policy in Ireland, how long do you think it will take the legal system to catch up to any revolution that is put in place?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think the background to this revolution that's required, it's arising from Ireland's obligations under international human rights law. So we've ratified the international treaty in 2018. It's called the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And that actually requires state parties like Ireland that have signed up to the convention to effectively repeal its mental health laws. So it means that you can't, it says that it's discriminatory to have mental health laws that can involuntarily detain and treat people. So it's going to take a long time to meet that standard. But there are examples of international best practice. For example, at the committee, there was discussion by some experts, by experience and other professionals around alternatives, which is a kind of a program in Norway that's moved towards mental health services that don't force people to take medication. So I think part of the problem here really is that there's a lack of choice within mental health services. There's real focus on pharmacological interventions, medication, and there isn't sufficient funding for community mental health services and alternatives to inpatient mental health services. So it's not just about the law, it's also about mental health services, how we spend our mental health budget and the lack of resources that are available for alternatives to inpatient treatment and detention.
Well, I appreciate the time this afternoon. That is Dr. Charles O'Mahony, law lecturer and head of the law school at NUI Galway on the Mental Health Amendment Bill of 2021. Now, the Samaritans have launched a campaign promoting awareness of mental health in rural Ireland. Joining me to discuss is Aileen Spiteri. She's regional head with the Samaritans. Good afternoon to you, Aileen.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
I am not too bad. Thank you for asking. So do tell us about the campaign that has been launched. How will people in rural Ireland note this campaign?
Well, it was the brainchild of a farmer called Peter Hines and his wife Paula. And they were looking for ways to reach people. And that's, Samaritans are always worried about the fact that we may not be reaching certain people because of where they live or for many reasons. And this campaign, thanks to the dairy industry, are putting Samaritan's details on the side of every truck, milk truck, that goes into every farmer's yard to collect the milk. So you'll notice them now that I've pointed them out. You know, they're a very new thing, and it means they're not huge, but if they're stopped outside a shop or they're in a farmer's yard, you'll notice our number 116123. And basically telling people that we're here to listen if they need to contact us for whatever reason.
Now, obviously, Samaritans want to get in touch with everybody, but isolated areas in particular can be a problem. And have you noted over the past 2 years, Aileen, an increase of people in those areas getting in touch? Or is this just something that has been something of note to Samaritans over the years?
Well, I suppose I'd like to say it has only been over the last 2 years. I think we've always been aware of the fact that there are people who feel isolated in cities and country areas. But I think in particular, there are particular things in rural areas. I think sometimes, like particularly over COVID, if you weren't able to travel, you weren't able to go to your local pub, your contacts, your sort of community that would have supported you generally were missing. And I think it really added to the isolation.
There's obviously the offices here in this county. We know we have an office in Newbridge, in Kildare, but there are rural places in County Kildare, as many people will know. And it means if they are in a more rural area, can they possibly go to any of the offices? Will there be more popping up in less populated areas? Or is this just more in tune with the free phone 116123?
At the moment, it's more with the free phone. Obviously, people can email us at joe@samaritans.ie as well, if they would prefer to contact us in that way. But for now, it's primarily the phone number. You know, it's hard to know what we might try and do in the future, but I think most people have a mobile phone. And I think for a lot of people, it means they can ring us unbeknownst to anybody else. It doesn't show up on a bill. It's completely confidential and no one is going to be looking for details. So if they just want to talk to someone in confidence, then phone is still probably the way most people will contact us. And I think during COVID, people said what they missed most of all was being able to talk to people. So that's really much of what we're responding to in that respect as well.
Now, the email you were saying, joe@samaritans, is that J-O?
J-O.
Okay, so joe@samaritans.org or .ie?
.ie.
.ie. So that's jo@samaritans.ie, and also the helpline number, as Aileen has pointed out, 116 123. There's also offices in Newbridge and Kildare, but if you are one of those people out in a more isolated rural area, you will note the signs and information will appear on approximately 500 milk trucks and vehicles throughout the country from today. And we know that is due to Mental Health Ag Week, or is it Ag Mental Health Week, Aileen?
Ag Mental Health Week, yeah.
Very good. Okay, so it's the brainchild of farmer and founder Peter Hines. And where is Peter from, Aileen?
He's from where I'm from, which is County Cork.
Very good.
From County Cork. And, you know, in some respects, people say it's a very simple idea, but aren't always the best ideas, the simple ones, really. It just takes someone to get behind it and go with it, really. So we're very grateful for the collaboration, really.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon and letting us know about that. That's Aileen Spiteri. She's Regional Head of Samaritans. That number, 116 123, anybody to reach out for help. Believe it or not, it's been 25 years of divorce in Ireland. That was at the end of February. And my next guest is going to discuss the impact it has had in the past 25 years on children. Dr. Kate Byrne is a child and adolescent psychologist from Selbridge. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
I am fine, thank you.
Good to hear. Thank you for inviting me on.
We appreciate you taking the time this afternoon, because at the end of February, 25 years ago, divorce legislation was enacted in this country. There was dire warnings at the time, supposedly. I have watched Reeling in the Years. I've seen some of the advertisements and newspaper clippings, and I find it quite hard to believe it was literally that dire, the warnings, especially when you look at a situation that's happening in a country like Ukraine right now. But children were the most worried about for many people. They felt like having divorce would absolutely destroy their childhood, destroy any possibility of a normal future they may have. What says you as a psychologist for both children and adolescents?
I would disagree with that. I mean, certainly it has been said by many people, better to have come from a broken home than to live in one. And I would work with a lot of youngsters who are or have recently or even in previous times experienced that. And the impact on mental health for young people in those situations is far more damaging than being in a happier and stable, more stable environment with one happier and more stable parent and with a relationship with the non-custodial parent or even shared custodial arrangements that the frameworks are there, the relationships are still there with both parents. And I think it's very, very important to remember that in that space, the relationship between the two adults is their own business. But both parents have those relationships that they build in a far more functional and healthy way with the children. And I suppose it's going back to, in a separation situation or a divorce situation, that both of the parents become collaborative colleagues in their dealing with any issues that come up with the children. And that's very, very important.
Now, a huge amount of research in regards to divorce and the effect it has on children has taken place over in America. A much higher divorce rate over there than this kind of side of the world when you're taking in the UK, is what I mean. So examples here, research has consistently found that children and teens from divorced families do less well academically on average than children from the nuclear intact families. My only question or comment on that would be that you may have a nuclear family, but it doesn't necessarily mean that all going on behind closed doors is as healthy or as stable compared to potential divorced family and what's happening in their homes and how they interact with each other, the partners who may once have been together.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, stresses and anxieties within a home, no matter what the family situation is, can lead to, you know, whatever's going on for the child or the teenager, that can increase the anxiety level of the child. And that's whether you're coming from a one-parent family situation or a dual family nuclear situation, or, you know, with warring parents, whether you're living together or whether you're not, you know, that has an impact on the stress levels and then the anxiety levels of the child. And it would be interesting to see kind of down the line the research piece on, you know, the functionality within relationship spaces for the children who come from those families, have, because in that dysfunctional space, how you go on to adulthood, how you interact with other people, and the relationships that you build are hugely influenced by what you've experienced in your childhood and in adolescence.
So I was mentioning the research there in terms of how people do in schooling, but psychologically and emotionally, there are, as you're mentioning, lots of negative impacts that can be had on these children who unfortunately have to live in a home or stay with parents that are warring, as you put it. You know, we'd have to research it to get a proper average.
I'd like to see the control group on that particular study, because certainly, you know, with children who, especially now, and I would say nowadays, we have far more cognizance of mental health, and that the resources that can be made available to children in those situations are far greater than they would have been, say, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, so I just want to ask you, even though we don't have that research in your, you know, area of work, what you've seen, how badly does parents staying together in I guess, toxic situation, situations, that is, affect the children that are in those households?
It affects the children hugely. It affects their stress levels, their anxiety levels.
Go into that a little bit more when it comes to, say, anxiety levels or stress levels, can you be a bit more specific?
Absolutely. You're living in an environment, you and your partner are in a situation of conflict. Because that's what your children's watching. They might be hearing it. They can sense the tension. That increases their stress levels, which in turn can elevate their anxiety levels. And that can impact their performance in school, even them wanting to go to school. It impacts their social relationships with their friends. It also kind of creates a sense of shame for the children in some cases, where they don't want to communicate it with somebody. And the younger the child is, obviously, the more they express themselves through their behaviors, because behaviors are a form of communication for children who find it overwhelming to deal with what's going on in their home environment, which will translate into their school environment as a way for people to notice that the child is certainly struggling with what they're going through. As it moves on, as a child gets a bit older, it can affect their relationships, not only with their peers and friends, but it can also impact their relationship with both parents. You know, you would see situations where, let's say, a young girl is seeing an issue between her two parents and may feel animosity towards her father. On the other hand, she may feel animosity towards her father and her mother for not doing something about it. So it has an impact on all those different aspects of their relationship building and their coping skills and mechanisms.
Again, this is just from your own personal experience with your job. Have you ever gotten your head around as to why some people decide to stay in relationships, in the sense why they feel like that would be better for their children? Because logically, it just seems from the outside looking in that it would always be better to, for anyone, no matter if you're a child or not, to be in a peaceful situation.
Absolutely. And I see, you know, I do understand certainly that there can be economic constraints which leave people in a situation where they're far more loath to leave the family home situation, or they feel that they wouldn't be able to cope without that kind of backup picture. Why would it be a good decision? You know, I suppose, again, looking at financial or socioeconomic stresses that might come in from leaving, there is a belief that, oh, well, look, I'll stay here because this will show the children stability and the sanctity of the marriage and the union, the two parents. But realistically, if that atmosphere and what's going on within that house is not right, and the stresses are there, your children are going to pick it up no matter how well you think you're hiding it.
How do you pick up the pieces, would say, 5-10 years down the line, when people may decide to separate formally, that is? Obviously, there can be economic reasons as to why people stay together, and lots of other reasons. We're not just focusing on one. But how does one pick up the pieces when they are a child of divorce, or potentially of not a divorce, causing even more problems in their lives?
Well, that's, you know, the place where different support services like Rainbows for the younger children and any kind of mental health support services are out there, that if a child feels, or an adolescent or an older person feels, that they are struggling with the outcome of what they've experienced, that then it's really important to have that safe space to be able to talk about it, open and honest communication. And if you know, everyone involved in that scenario feels that the child needs more or the individual needs more, then, you know, it's looking for the professional support to be able to kind of work through that.
I'm looking over an article here that notes avoid deliberately putting children in the middle of things. If a child has been put in the middle of things, no matter what their age, again, because it can happen throughout a person's life, how does one, I guess, navigate the way out of that current cycle that they may be caught in?
Well, I think that the parents who are involved in that situation need those psychological supports as well. You know, and being able to have mediation, being able to go and talk to somebody who's not involved in the situation. And then I'm kind of going back to the kind of mental health counselling and supports and stuff like that are really, really important. I'm going to say something probably quite controversial, but, you know, I see a lot of cases where there's been a lot of parental alienation within those situations, which has an impact on the relationship of the children with one or other of the parents, where the children become a bit of a pawn in a chess game, which is really, really unfair. And to recognise that and to apologise and look at what steps can be taken, both personally and professionally, to move forward from that situation, because it can do irreparable damage to the children's relationship with their non-custodial parents.
So 25 years down the line, do you feel like divorce has had a positive impact on Irish society, or do you feel things, I guess, still aren't where they should be?
I think that to move it to where it should be, then is to be a greater recognition of the supports that need to go in place when a couple are thinking of divorcing, because often it's all about the legal aspects and the house and everything like that, and who's getting custody and who's getting the dog. As opposed to it being like that, there should be like family mediation services, somebody supporting them with the whole planning process of doing what they need to do in the best interest of everybody involved in it.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time this afternoon. That is Dr. Kate Byrne. She is a child and adolescent psychologist from Selbridge on the topic of 25 years on divorce in Ireland and the impact it has on children. Thanks, Kate. We're joined on the line by policy manager with One Family. That is Niamh Kelly. And Niamh, you might have heard in the past few moments what we're speaking to child and adolescent psychologist Dr. Kate Byrne about 25 years of divorce in Ireland. And you're joining us today, I should say, to let us know about what One Family are doing in terms of a survey, because this is learning about the experiences of young children living in families where the parents are separated.
Yes, Ciara, I was listening to Kate there. So very relevant for our research, I suppose. We're looking at the experience of families with very young children who have contact arrangements set up between the parents to facilitate both parents seeing the young baby or the infant. And what we're looking to do is really, I suppose, we noticed through our services and our work with families that there's a lack of a regimented approach towards contact between parents who are separated, and also parents who maybe were never together in the first place. And a lot of times the contact arrangements that are set up are done so informally between the families, between the parents. Sometimes they're negotiated and set up by the courts. But even in the courts, there's not a unified approach. There's not guidelines to help legal professionals. There's no supports for parents in setting this up. And I suppose we're very conscious of the needs of very young children. I mean, the age group we're looking at is 0 to 6. And that age group, you know, there's so much happens during that time, and their development is so important, and their attachment with their parents are important, and there's so many different factors that can influence the future of their lives, that it's such an important time. And what we are trying to do is by doing this research, is establish a best practice guideline for legal professionals, for social care professionals, but also for families themselves, so that when they're in this difficult time, they're setting up these contact arrangements, that they have something to rely on that shows what's in the best interests of children, and really it's child-centred approach to this area.
So the survey is open to all parents who have experience of sharing or parenting of a child or children when they're between the ages of 0 or a few months, few weeks, whatever that may be, up to 6 years old. And the parents can answer for past experiences also once their child is under 18 years of age. That's at the time of response. So if people want more information about actually getting to the survey, where can they go and when does the survey close?
The survey is open until the end of March, and if anyone has that experience, as you mentioned, we're looking for parents who have had contact arrangements between 0 and 6 years old. And as I said, it doesn't have to be parents who were in a relationship. It could be people who weren't in a relationship to begin with and have a child together. And we're looking, it's available at www.onefamily.ie on our website.
Okay, well, I greatly appreciate it. I hear a little child in the background there, Niamh, so I'm sure you're busy. We'll
parenting,
let you go.
Parenting from work today.
There so you go. Yeah, you're showing you can do it all, juggling it. International Women's Day yesterday, you're showing how they do it. Thank you so much for joining me. That's Niamh Kelly, Policy Manager with One Family. And just reading some of the information here, it's going to be looking at the complexities and difficulties around decisions on guardianship, access and custody. Also, the contact arrangements, as Niamh was saying, from parents' point of view following separation, divorce, where the parents were never in a relationship but have a child. First time in Ireland that the issue has been subject of a research study. That's quite interesting. It took a while. I suppose people say it took a while for divorce to come into Ireland in the first place. People say it still takes a while to get divorced in this country compared to others. You can do it in a matter of weeks in some countries. You have to be what now since the vote 4 years separated? I think 3 years out of the four separated before you can legally divorce in this country. And it notes recent times have witnessed a variety of legal and policy developments in this country in the area of children's rights, but often the voices of smaller children are left unheard. So the survey's open to parents of 0 to 6 year olds. Or you can also comment or make a comment through the survey if your child is under 18 years of age. That is open until the 31st of March this year. And it will take approximately 20 to 30 minutes to complete.
K-Drive with Paul Power. Monday to Friday, Kildare's KFM.
Is it just me or does the traffic just seem to get busier and busier? Well, thankfully on K-Drive, we keep an eye on that for you each and every day. Monday to Friday from 4 till 7, a regular check on the traffic. We've also got the birthday club, and of course we play musical Connect Four, loads and loads of your favourite songs and lots more besides. That's K-Drive with me, Paul Power, every day Monday to Friday from 4 here on Kildare's KFM
with Fitzpatrick's Hyundai, Kildare and Nace.
Kildare's KFM.
Go racing at Nace Racecourse this Sunday, March 13th for the Bar One Racing Leinster National Day. It's our richest national hunt race, worth €100,000. Book into our panoramic restaurant from just €55. Free creche facilities for the kids too. Tickets at naceracecourse.com.
Nua Healthcare are looking to recruit team members with a passion for caring for others. Make a difference. Be part of our team. Extensive training will be provided with full-time and relief positions available in our centres in County Kildare and existing centres across the country. Start your career in social care now. For more information, email recruitment at nuahealthcare.ie or see nuahealthcare.ie. Nua Healthcare, passion for caring.
Canon Skips, low-cost skip hire. For discounts, quote KFM. Call us free on 1-800-528-543. canonskips.com.
It's the colours, the styles, the fabrics, the on-trend designs and more. It's the home event at Easy Living Interiors, online and in-store. It's the velvet sofas and dining sets, the beds and luxury on view. It's incredible savings everywhere you look and expert advice too. Give your home a style refresh this spring with Easy Living Interiors. Check out our home event for amazing value. Easy Living Interiors, Sandyford, Nace, Navan and M1 Retail Park, Drogheda. Sale ends Sunday.
Eating better is easier at Dunn Stores, with 20 varieties of fruits and vegetables, all only 49 cent each. Create delicious meals like all-veg Thai green curry, full of flavoursome baby potatoes, courgettes and peppers, all for only 49 cent each, meaning big flavours and new ideas all month long. Plus, with our 10 off 50 grocery voucher, you save even more. Dunn Stores, always better value. Terms and conditions apply. Voucher can be used on ex-grocery shop of €50 or more.
Suffering from hearing loss or tinnitus? Contact Bonavox Hearing Specialists, 1 Cutlery Road, Newbridge, to avail of a free hearing assessment. With over 50 years' experience, trust us with your hearing needs. Check out bonavox.ie for our unbeatable offers.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Noble.
So it is, of course, St. Patrick's Day next week, and we have 2 days off, the 17th and 18th. They're both bank holidays. Well, not everybody has them off. I do know that. Not everybody has them off. But a lot of people are looking forward to it. And we've heard just in the past few minutes that the actor John C. Reilly, he is the actor from Step Brothers. He played a lot with Will Ferrell. He was also in Talladega Nights. He is so funny. I actually saw John C. Reilly once, and I was totally starstruck. I saw him in Cannes. I know, very bougie of me. It was during the film festival and he's in one of those amazing hotels and I saw him there and I was like, oh my God. Anyway, he's going to be the international guest of honour at this year's St. Patrick's Day parade in the capital city. He's 56. He's obviously of American-Irish heritage, as you can imagine from the name there. He grew up in an Irish-Lithuanian household in Chicago and he will appear alongside the Grand Marshals Ellen Keane and Kelly Harrington in the parade. Taking place, obviously, when else? The 17th of March. And on the 16th, that is the day before the Wednesday, we will go through all the local parades that are happening in the county on Kildare Focus. We're going to have all the local areas like Newbridge, Clane, Kilcock. All of them will be on so you can hear what's happening on St. Patrick's Day around your area. Now, 78,000 college applications have been made this year, but that is a 1.5% decrease on last year, believe it or not. Brian Mooney joins me now. He's a guidance counsellor and education columnist with the Irish Times. Hi, Brian.
Good morning, Ciara. Good afternoon, Ciara.
Good morning. Just out of bed, are we, Brian?
Well, no, not quite.
Good, good. You need to be up and at it for these CAO situations. So arts, environment and language courses, they've all seen a massive increase in the first preference choices.
Yeah, language is up 17%, humanities up 4%, arts up 6%. But, I mean, the overall picture is it's a wonderful, you know, if you actually see what it's capturing in terms of Ireland today, I mean, 24.5% decrease in over 23s. You know, down 2,140 to 6,587. You know, and when you look at that along with the HEAR applications, which are social disadvantage, they're also down nearly 8%. You know, there's a lot of people who may have gone to college previously who are either having to work, wanting to work, getting jobs in a recovering economy, etc. So in a sense, your drop in numbers is exclusively coming from that source. Obviously, the number of school leavers has gone up again this year, as it will every year for the next 5 or 6 years. And they are within those figures, obviously, because there will be additional students from Leaving Cert level applying to college. But the overall picture is, in fact, of, you know, people who are maybe that few years older who might previously have gone to college. They're now either gone to work, looking for work, or can't afford to go to college, obviously, because of the kind of cost pressures and cost of living pressures that we're under.
Okay, we were mentioning arts, environment and language courses yeah. increasing. If you look at nursing and a lot of the health-related courses, they have showed some of yeah. the steepest decreases.
27% decrease in nursing applications. You know what I mean?
Is that pandemic-related, in your opinion?
Of course it is. I mean, it's just people looking at the experience of what it was like for 2 years. I mean, it's had an absolutely devastating effect in terms of the application for nursing. And I mean, you know, obviously it's a reflection, you know, of how young people perceive professions. And they're obviously looking over the last 2 years and saying, maybe that isn't for me. Whereas on the other hand, I can give you one prediction. I can tell you the points for something this year before we even start. Obviously, you remember last year, there were 4-degree programs, Ciara, where the points requirements were 6-2-5, and not every applicant got a place. Two of those were the two dentistry degrees. And effectively, to get dentistry last year, you had to have 6-2-5, and you weren't even guaranteed to get it to 6-2-5 because it was random selection. The numbers for dentistry are up 12%. So effectively, I can pretty much predict today, dentistry will be 6-2-5 again this year, and not everybody on 6-2-5 will probably get a place.
And that will be difficult for people who've obviously... That's difficult for people who've repeated or maybe, you know, hoping to go again for the second year if they may have missed out on dentistry.
Absolutely. And another fascinating insight, if you remember last year, we had a huge increase in European students coming to Ireland who would have previously gone to the UK. They wanted a degree taught through English and they were looking for a European country, which is English speaking, which was in the EU. i.e. Ireland or maybe Malta, which is tiny. So the numbers again this year from Europe are up 16%. And last year, up to 1,000 of those students actually registered and took up places. So in a sense, we are now becoming the attractive European country. And in the same way as lots of Irish students are going to the Netherlands to do the likes of physio and you know other degrees in that area, they are now coming here because they want to be educated exclusively in an English environment. And the cost of going to the UK, obviously they're now international students in the UK, so they're not going there anymore, they're coming here. And that has had, you know, a significant, massive increase last year and a further 16% increase this year. And they are competing with our students for those places that they are perfectly entitled to do.
And British applications have also increased. That's by 9%.
Yeah, but look, if you look at the, what's the overall number for Europe? 5,401. Britain, 983. And last year, 43% of the Europeans who got an offer took it, 21% of the British took it. So effectively, you know, we're far more popular in continental Europe in terms of a destination than we are in Britain. I mean, it's what would 20% of the continental number actually applying from our nearest neighbour, which probably tells you something as well.
Now, the popular fields of study, business, law and science, there's also a decrease there. Any reason for that?
Well, I think if you look at it, there's an overall decrease in numbers of, say, for instance, 3%. So when you factor that in, you know, business is down 3%, but the overall applications are down 3%. Law is down 5%, but if the numbers are down 5%, then that's 2%. So, you know, these are very marginal numbers. But, I mean, if you look at areas like environment, now, again, they're small numbers, but the number looking for courses in the environment, which is obviously a consciousness and awareness of our environment, is up 35%. Now, I know it's only from 532 to 877. Architecture, you know, obviously we are going to be building very strongly for the next number of years, up 11%. You know, so if you contrast, say, the overall health sciences application is down 12% and the overall number for architecture up 11%, basically, people see the jobs are going to be in the building and maybe careers in healthcare after 2 years of the pandemic aren't as attractive as they might once have been.
Very briefly, Brian, just we're stuck for time here. What's the key message you would give for CAO applicants this year?
The key message is ultimately make sure that you cover all your bases. Obviously, go back in May and June and look again at the options. You can change your mind and relist your courses right up to the 1st July. Make sure that you have a backup plan in relation to maybe a further education course that would take you back into the CAO with the reserve places. And given all the continental students that are looking at Ireland, you look at the European options through English in Dutch universities and other places where they've never heard of points and all they're looking for is your 2 H5s and your 4 passes. So just make sure you cover your bases. Have something solid to go towards in August. Don't find yourself having listed only CAO courses at high points and then find yourself looking at a blank sheet when you look at your offers.
Okay, look at your options. Great advice there. That is, of course, Brian Mooney. He is a guidance counsellor and an education columnist with the Irish Times. Thank you so much. The CAO applications have decreased overall, but not much of a difference if you take into account what Brian was noting. Now, I was speaking at the beginning of the show in terms of prices, you know, where things are going. We know inflation's everywhere. We get it, we get it. But some good news ish, if you are a commuter, the new tax saver commuter tickets will be reduced by 20%. That is from the 1st of April. We need to take all the good news we can possibly get. So this is the NTA, the National Transport Authority, saying this. It's the first phase of reductions to public transport fares, which were announced by the government last month. So a 20% cut in fares for public services outside Dublin, obviously here in this county, comes into effect from the middle of April, while tickets in the greater Dublin area, parts of County Kildare is in, will see a reduction from early May. So some savings possibly to be had there.